everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here at Game Wisdom. I am Josh Bicer, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, a writer who looks at the intersect between psychology and video games, Jamie Madigan.
Hi, how are you?
Great, Jamie. It's nice to meet you.
You as well. Glad to be on. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yep, no problem. So let's begin with some introductions. If you could talk a little bit about who you are and what type of games you like to play.
Sure. Jamie Madigan, and I play a lot of different games. I play probably mostly action adventure, on the PC and consoles as well. I just bought an Xbox One, right around launch time, and, have played through kind of the games that interested me on that. So I'll be waiting for additional stuff to come out there. But, you know, I play online shooters, RPGs, some strategy games, not a lot of sports. Not a lot of simulation, but there you have it.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same way. I keep seeing everyone talking about that Euro Truck Simulator. I'm just like sitting there shaking my head going, why do people keep playing this?
Yeah, I watched a Let's Play of that for about, 15 minutes or so before I just shook my head and thought, I just don't get it. Must be me. And turned it off.
Yeah. Now, with the Xbox One, how did you find it? Because I've been hearing people saying they're a bit disappointed with the recent catalogs for both the PS4 and Xbox One.
I like it a lot, more than I thought I would. And, you know, the launch lineup is sort of to be expected. They're never stellar launch lists of games for these consoles when they first come out. But I played through Assassin's Creed 4 and Dead Rising 3, and then played a little bit of Peggle 2. on that as well, just kind of goof around. And I like it. I like TV integration more, a lot more than I ever expected to. You know, when they initially were showing that stuff off previous to E3 and talking about how it's going to be the center of your TV viewing experience and the guide and all that, I thought, no thanks. You know, not really interested in this. But I ended up kind of running the TV through the Xbox just to save an HDMI port on the back of my TV because I only had two. And I don't use the guide stuff because I have a DVR, but it's really cool to be able just to walk into the room and say, you know, Xbox on, Xbox Watch TV, and then grab your DVR remote control. And it works really well, and you can switch over to your friends list or messages or games really quickly and easily, and then turn it off with your voice as well. So the TV and the voice integration were a pleasant surprise. I didn't expect to use the Kinect stuff at all either. And the motion control stuff, I'm still uninterested in, but the voice command stuff is actually pretty cool.
Interesting. I have been hearing a lot, at least with the Xbox 360, that people were a bit lukewarm about the Kinect and all that. So
yeah.
With the Xbox One, has it been improved, or did you actually have the 360 and use that Kinect?
I never got the Kinect for the 360 because I never saw the appeal. Mm-hmm. And from what I understood, the voice control stuff on the 360 Kinect wasn't as integrated or extensive as it is on the Xbox One. So, yeah, I never used it, so I can't really compare. Didn't have anything like that on my PS3 either.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I find interesting that you were just saying about the Xbox becoming sort of the centerpiece of your home entertainment system is sort of what Valve's going to be doing with the Steam Box at some point. That they're trying to effectively bridge that gap between the PC and the home audience, and they're going to try to make the Steam Box pretty much almost in the same vein as the Xbox, to try to be your, you know, one-stop center for home entertainment.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've been watching that and paying attention to it. I think it's probably a long game on their part, just in terms of getting all the publishers to move over to, you know, Linux and port their games over, and so you don't have just 100 indie games or 100 small games or 100 older games and I guess id's entire catalog on there to play. I'll probably pick one up eventually. I don't think I'll be part of the first generation on that. Just kind of let people work out the bugs and then let a cheap model come out that I can pick up for a couple hundred dollars, or maybe see if I can figure out how to take some old computer parts and buy what I need to build one myself. Because apparently you'll be able to do that. You can download Steam OS and just install it and, you know, buy the Steam controller and check all that out.
What do you think about the Steam controller? I think since the last time I saw, they have made some revisions to it.
Yeah, I unfortunately haven't ever got to touch one or even see one in person. So I'm pretty skeptical about it. The haptic feedback on the little thumb nub thingies sounds interesting. Like they vibrate. Is it either the further away from the center you get or the closer to the center, but whatever, they offer like some kind of resistance. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, have a lot of different points of contact mm-hmm. and sort of always know where your thumbs are on the virtual mm-hmm. thumbsticks. I'd love to check one out. Maybe someday I'll be able to walk into Best Buy and they'll have a display set up, or, you know, maybe I'll go visit somebody that has one, or eventually buy one myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, who do you think the Steam Box is currently being marketed to? Do you think it's for PC users, or more in general to like the home consumers or the guys who have mostly been console centric?
I think it's probably largely marketed right now in such that it is marketed at all towards the PC crowd. Mm-hmm. Just because it seems like they're the ones who have a Steam library. They're the ones who know about Steam and, you know about Steam sales, where they can go pick up all these games for cheap to play on their Steam Box. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea, I think, behind the Steam controller is to make it easy to play games that you would normally need a mouse and keyboard for. You know, mm-hmm. you're going to be able to play Civilization 5 on your couch in front of your big TV mm-hmm. With the Steam Box. Seems to be one of the selling points. I think that's who they're marketing at right now. If they can get that device cheap enough and, you know, on Walmart shelves where mm-hmm. people can go in and say, like, okay, I can play this thing, and it says that it has, like, 600 games available for it, then, yeah, the parents are going to, you know, look at picking that up, and people will be a lot more likely to pick it up as well. You know, I can play all the games that I already own, and then there's all these other games that I can pick up, you know, for cheap or for free, you know, in the case of free-to-play games. If they can get to that point, I think they'll make a killing. Mm-hmm. Or they'll spend a lot of money and nothing will ever come mm-hmm. of it, which, you know, wouldn't surprise me given Valve's past and the amount of money they seem to have.
Yep, and Valve time as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, but I think if anyone is going to be able to directly compete with Microsoft, both in terms of an OS and in terms of a console market, Valve probably is the best competitor at the moment. They seem to arguably be one of the biggest companies out there.
They're just so flush with cash,
yeah.
From what I understand, through Steam, mostly, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like they put out games all that frequently, although mm-hmm. I guess when they do, they sell pretty well. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think Steam is just a big money hat for them, and mm-hmm. They're a privately held company, so they don't have to disclose anything about mm-hmm. you know, their finances, and they can play it close to the vest and not have to worry about making bad impressions on shareholders for wasting money on crazy things like virtual reality rigs or hardware and Steam controllers and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, you may be right.
Yeah, I mean, last year was, the 10-year anniversary of Steam, and it just seems so weird that...
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, I feel old again, too. I remember when, you know, Steam was just this weird program that, why do I want to install this thing on my computer? It's going to,
You want to play Half-Life 2, right?
Yeah, that was it. And then I was like, I'm never using this again. And then, like, 2007, 2008, I bought the Orange Box, and then I was pretty much attached to Steam for the rest of my life.
Yep. Yeah, I just kind of looked up one day and realized that I just, for, like, $19, I just bought 15 games. And one of the sales, and everything is linked, and I don't do digitally distributed games anymore unless, you know, I can play them through Steam at the very least, mm-hmm. Preferably buy them through Steam.
Yeah. I mean, same thing with me. I'm pretty much all Steam and GOG at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I had Origin for SimCity, mm-hmm. which that didn't work out very well yeah. for me. So I haven't launched that app in months since, like, March, April?
Yeah, I think it was, like, March when it came out.
Yeah. And then I got my money back on it and haven't launched it since. Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah, Steam. I play a lot of Team Fortress 2 still to this mm-hmm. day. That's sort of my I've got half an hour to kill game that I go to fire up.
Yeah.
I got about 500 hours in that, which... It's not a lot for some people, but it's by far and away the most I've ever put into a single game, including MMOs and anything.
Yeah, for me, it's Left 4 Dead and then Team Fortress 2 are, like, my top two games I play the most on Steam.
Yeah, cool.
Now, I guess the other digital platform I tried using this a few days ago was Games for Windows Live, so I know that it's slowly but surely dying out, and
yeah.
And, of course, the second I try to load it up, there's a connection issue. It's not letting me connect to the service anymore.
Yeah, that's being sunset, isn't it?
Yeah, I think...
They're, like, taking it out of games. And I guess the last one that I guess some people that I know of care about is Dark Souls that still requires it.
Mm-hmm. And who knows if what's going on with Dark Souls, because I know that people were pretty much not too happy when it was announced to have it in the first place as opposed to using the Steam architecture.
Yeah. I played Dark Souls on the PS3, mm-hmm. so I didn't have to deal with all that. Mm-hmm. Although I'm constantly tempted to pick it up on the PC just to play the extra mm-hmm. content and high resolution and DS fix and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, I have to, at some point, I have to reinstall mine. I have to update the latest DS fix. So I think one patch broke it, so now they have to do another one. But by that point, I do wonder if multiplayer will even be an option.
Yeah. All right. I don't know. I hated doing multiplayer in Dark Souls. I actually went into offline mode a lot just to avoid getting invaded.
Yeah, I heard the second one's going to be a bit more refined in terms of multiplayer, at least what the little snippets have been released about it.
Yeah, that's soon, too, isn't it? That's like next month.
Yeah. I know that Dark Souls came out a few years for the PS3, but it just came out for the PC, so it just seems so new at this point.
Yeah.
All right, now I'm speaking about EA and SimCity, or just EA in general. That actually takes us to the news I want to talk about this week, and that is the Dungeon Keeper fiasco that's been happening on the mobile phones. So, of course, EA made a great image of themselves. They did all kinds of great things right when they decided to release Dungeon Keeper as a free-to-play game for the mobile phones. And people have been reporting not only is it just completely bare bones, like you just click blocks and then the rooms pop up and that's it, but it's also one of the most heavily monetized games from EA since I think it was called Real Racing or something that came out a few months ago or last year.
Yeah, and that's saying a lot. This is EA we're talking about. If it's the heaviest, monetization treatment they've given a game, that's got to be pretty drastic.
Yeah, from what people have been saying, when you start trying to dig out the tiles or the blocks in your dungeon, they force you to wait. So some points it gets to the, 24 hours a block to break it open, unless, of course, you buy their gems or their premium currency. And it, of course, gets even better than that when people found that when you go to rate the game, if you give it a 5-star, it says, thank you, and this will help us support free updates and whatever. But if you try to give it below 5, they want you to go take like 3 or 4 extra steps to report it to EA.
Oh, no.
So
really?
Yeah. So, of course, most people aren't going to put up with that crap. So the game obviously has tons and tons of 5-stars of people saying, why do I want to spend the extra time? And EA's reporting, the game's doing great. We got 5-stars for everything.
That's so slimy. That's ridiculous. I hadn't heard that little bit about the rating. That's really interesting. There might be an article in that to write up.
Yeah, I mean, that just takes it to like a whole other level of sleazy business. I could, some kind of crazy rationalize the game requiring, pay or wait because that's normal for mobile markets. But to try, trick their rating system like that.
Yeah. I think at this point they should just lie. They should just, make up numbers. Because to me, somehow that would be more honest, Mm-hmm. It would be fewer steps involved in the lie, a less extensive lie than tricking people or making it inconvenient for people to give it anything but a 5-star. I would almost hate that less.
Yep, and then, of course, when this was discovered, EA spokesperson, pulled out the usual BS about, we have no problem with this. People love our game. And I was just getting, parallels to the whole SimCity issues when, the barbarians were at the gate and Max was like, it's fine. The game's great. People wanted social multiplayer and always on DRM. We were giving it to the fans.
Nope. Yeah. That didn't pan out, did it?
Mm-hmm. And I think a few days ago, they announced, Peter Molyneux actually wrote a little thing about saying that he was, annoyed and disgusted with what EA did to Dungeon Keeper.
Yeah, I don't blame him. I played the original Dungeon Keeper back in the day, mm-hmm. but I haven't played this new one. I read an article about the shenanigans that you just mentioned and decided not to bother. Mm-hmm. But, I could see how he would be upset. It's amazing that people put up with that or spend money on it. It just seems so transparent, so flagrant, mm-hmm. and so annoying.
And there's definitely an interesting article in that, just in terms of like psychology of people who play those types of games and the ones who are willing to spend, you know, $20, $30+ on like simple upgrades, or, you know, will cut out the middleman or will speed up the time it takes you to do something, even if it's in a game as basic as what people reporting that Dungeon Keeper became.
Yeah, it seems to have like the old farm, almost the Farmville time mechanic, where you do something and then you have to wait, like you were saying, and mm-hmm. you either have to wait hours and hours or you pay mm-hmm. to keep it going. So, yeah, to the extent that, you know, people sort of formalize a goal in their mind of, you know, I want to mine out this room or I want to build this thing, mm-hmm. then they're a lot more likely to stick with that goal and do what it takes. I'm guessing that the game uses some sort of funny money, like mm-hmm. gems or coins. And so you're not paying like 99 cents to do something. You're paying like 2 purple diamonds or something
yeah,
like that.
I know it definitely features gems as like the premium currency, but I don't know what the actual currency, the translation model works.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot like spending money in a foreign currency.
Yeah.
You know, you lose track of how much you've spent. So you'll buy a stock of diamonds or gems, and then you know, that money is gone. You feel like you've spent it and it's a sunk cost, and you've got all these free gems now that are just sitting around, and you don't think of them as money anymore. So,
yeah.
you know, you're more likely to spend them, and then, oh, hey, you're out again.
Yep.
10 minutes later.
Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, that phenomenon that once you spend money on the game, it becomes easier and easier to keep spending because you already made that initial investment. So you
yep.
feel compelled, or you feel like you're hooked on that product and you want to keep putting into it.
Yep, that's another example of sunk costs. It's like, I've already spent this money. It would be a waste for me to step away now. I would waste all the money that I've already spent, even though either way, it's gone. It's spent. You're not getting it back.
Yep, in for a penny, in for a pound, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I've never really fallen down that. Well, I can't say never. There's mm-hmm. been one or two microtransactions or in-app purchases I've made, but generally try to steer clear of that.
Yeah, me too. I think the only free-to-play game that actually got me to spend money on was League of Legends, and that was after
okay.
spending, wow, like 30, 40 hours of getting my ass killed in ranked matches and people yelling at me and just a very happy-go-lucky time. And this was, of course, before they did their whole remodeling the reputation and the
mm-hmm.
tribunal system. So I got when I was at like the thickest and the most abrasive to play that game.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting talking about psychology and video games. The guy, Jeffrey Lynn, that leads up their, what do they call it, like their player behavior organization at Riot,
mm-hmm.
Is a psychologist, and they put a lot of effort and time and money into studying
mm-hmm.
sort of the economics and psychology behind their various systems, like the tribunal system and their honor system and their microtransactions
mm-hmm.
and all that sort of stuff. So those people are doing really cool work, and, you know, it's goes beyond figuring out what the right price points are. They even look at like the effects of presenting text in different colored mm-hmm. fonts and like
yeah.
how that affects average, you know, player behaviors, or whether or not people drop out of matches and
mm-hmm.
or how cordial or rude they are to each other. And
mm-hmm.
They do some really cool work. It's nice to see somebody doing that.
Yeah. And I know at one point Valve actually hired an economist on the staff when they were going about changing Team Fortress 2 into
mm-hmm.
its free to play and monetization model.
And yeah,
they also did a really great job, I think, of basically giving both paying players and free players the same amount of content or the same amount of enjoyment out of the game.
Yeah, yeah, they do, and that economist occasionally will do blog posts where he'll talk about some experiments that they did in their little economy and
mm-hmm.
how it affects the price of hats and keys and. Mm-hmm. And all that sort of stuff. And they actually have an experimental psychologist working there as well, who's works on the Team Fortress 2. I think they kind of float around.
Mm-hmm.
I actually visited Valve a couple of years ago. They brought
nice.
Me out for an interview
mm-hmm.
to work there. And so it was really interesting to see what they do and talk to them. And that was right at the time where they were opening the Manco store.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could go in and pay real money to buy hats and
yeah.
weapons and stuff for Team Fortress 2. And they were really excited about that and put a lot of work into it. And
mm-hmm.
seems like they've kept it going over the years too.
Yep. And again, speaking about like how our perception changes, I remember when the Manco Sword was announced, everyone was pretty much yelling at Valve saying they ruined Team Fortress. I'm never playing again. This will never work. And lo and behold, not only did it work, but it's becoming, you know, like millions of dollars of revenue. People are actually making money off of it. I know Ken, who's been on the cast a few times, he's talked about how much money he's made selling random hats and stuff.
Wow.
And it's insane. Like, and as you said, there's its whole unique economy model just for selling hats. And this is worth, you know, one hat, and this hat could be worth five other hats. And it's just insane to think about all this is happening with cosmetic items that literally serve no gameplay purpose to playing the game.
Yeah, the economist, I wish I could remember his name, but he wrote a post and said, like, one of the reasons I wanted to come to Valve and do this is that because this is like a perfect economy. In other words, it's like a textbook economy, and it's not subject to all the real world sort of things that mess with real world economies and restrictions and assumptions that aren't upheld. You know, it's like this is a closed system, or it's a highly controllable system. And some real economist out there is probably screaming into his, you know, iPod right now. But I think the point was that, like, you could do a lot of the stuff that academics have always wanted to do and to always study in an economy because it is an artificial one. And yeah, they tied the whole marketplace into it. And so now you can buy and sell stuff on the marketplace and from other players instead of buying it directly from Valve and get rid of your extra stuff there. Although nobody ever wants to buy my crates. I can't seem to unload those for even a penny on the marketplace, but I've sold a few things, and I generally will do that, and then we'll buy the man up tickets to play the cooperative mode, the man versus machine, and do that so that I can then get more loot and more items. So it is kind of a vicious circle, but yeah, for the amount of time I put into that game, I'm happy to throw them, you know, $5 every couple of months.
Yeah, I have items up too that I've seen them, like, listed. I see someone bought for like $20. I have mine listed for like $10 and no one wants it. I'm just like sitting there going, damn it. While like people are making all this money. And the same goes for the Steam cards too. I know there's people who are just going gaga over those. I've got.
Yeah.
I bought like a few cards in the beginning just to complete some badges that I like. But then after that, I just started selling them. I made, I think, like $20 so far in total. Helped me buy Prison Architects, so I guess that's a win at least.
Yeah, that when they rolled those out in the summer sale last year, right? I was kind of like, this is stupid. This is so crass. They're just manipulating people. And then, oh, you know what? I only need two more cards to complete this badge and craft this badge, and you can get them for like 23¢ each on the marketplace. So what the hell? And before I knew it, I was buying and selling the cards and caught up in the whole thing. So just knowing about something doesn't make you immune to it.
I love how each one of these decisions Valve has made, we both say that we first thought, oh, it's horrible, it's never going to work, and then of course it sells like freaking gangbusters. So maybe that's Valve's strategy. To like reverse psychology us and doing all this stuff.
Yeah, and I think they just try a lot of different things and see what sticks.
Now, one thing that I found interesting as a quick aside about Valve, the studio Turtle Rock Studios, they're the ones who made Left 4 Dead 1, then they were bought by Valve to do Left 4 Dead 2. They talked about how after being bought by Valve and working with them, that they didn't really like the culture of Valve. They didn't felt that really meshed with their type of personality. So they actually got out, or they're no longer part of Valve to work on another game. So it is kind of interesting, because Valve, as we know, is a very different company. They're also pretty secretive in terms of how things work. I mean, the only information we really get are maybe like little teases and snippets of ex-employees and stuff like that.
And then they had that employee handbook that was supposedly leaked last year. Did you ever take a look at that?
I saw parts of it, but I honestly don't remember anything substantial from it.
Yeah, it was a lot about like how flat their organization is, and we have no managers, and everybody is free to make their own decisions, and because we have so much money that we can afford to do this sort of thing, and we're a creative company. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so it's definitely interesting. I mean, I thought at one point I would like to work at Valve, but I don't think that my personality or my way of doing things would fit in. I don't consider myself a jack-of-all-trades type person. I think I'm really good at coming up with design, thinking how things will work together, but I don't see myself as someone who could do design, and they could do a little bit of programming, and they could do a little bit of art, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah, it does seem like that people there do play in a lot of different fields. Mm-hmm. And when the guys that I was talking to is like, yeah, so-and-so is teaching me how to code, and so-and-so is teaching me how to do level design, mm-hmm. Which I imagine for some people does really appeal to them and sounds really cool. But if you're the kind of person like, no, man, I just want to do this thing and, mm-hmm. and I want to be really good at it, leave me alone, then they're probably not going to leave you alone.
Yeah, basically the guys who prefer doing one thing really well as opposed to doing five or six things just marginally or average.
Yeah, yeah. Although, apparently, Valve does turn out pretty good products somehow. even if they have a bunch of people working on average jobs, which I somehow kind of doubt. They do a pretty good job. Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'll still be alive when Half-Life 3 comes out at some point.
No.
I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's ever going to happen. Or if it does, it'll be something weird like a free-to-play MOBA or or a collectible card game or something.
Or better yet, a first-person trading card game using the Oculus Rift and the Steam Box controllers.
yeah, that's it. Heard it here first. I'm gonna write that down.
And if they do that, I want residuals from that.
I'll see what I can do for you.
All right, so let's move on. Jamie, do you have any interesting news pieces or anything you want to bring up?
No, not really. The only thing story that I'm kind of baffled by and been following a little bit is this. A little slip there. Following it a little bird is the Flappy Bird game, which I actually never got a chance to download it. I kept meaning to, but now it looks like I don't have an opportunity to. It was apparently a fiendishly difficult little tap-to-play game where you guided this little bird through gaps between pipes, and apparently the pipes and the bird have a suspicious similarity to some certain Mario art and franchise. But a lot of the difficulty of the game apparently was owed to the control schemes and how finicky and difficult it is to control the little bird to get him through the gaps. And, you know, it's the kind of game where a score of one would be, yeah, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you got two, then you were really on fire. And if you got three, then you were godlike.
Yeah.
But then apparently, the guy who created it, it blew up. It came insanely popular, went viral, and the guy it was a free-to-play game, and he didn't have any in-app purchases or anything like that, but he had ad revenue through the game, and he was making, $50,000 a day or more on this game. But then he up and suddenly just said, I can't take this anymore. This thing has ruined my life. I'm taking it down. Flappy Bird is gone. Goodbye. You know, don't try to find me, kind of reaction. And I just think that's so weird and so interesting that, you know, he had this incredible success and apparently he may be the sort of person who valued his privacy or didn't want life complicated, or maybe he was worried about lawsuits from somebody or somebody kept bothering him to buy the property or whatever it was, but he decided to just pull the plug. You know, I think if it were me in that situation, I wanted to do the same thing. I would have come up with a little bit more creative way to go under. You know, I might have made it a $10 purchase, and, you know, for the app or something, or just, you know, done something completely weird like that, or said you know, you donate $1 million to my Kickstarter, or I'm going to kill Flappy Bird. You know, for every $1 million I don't receive, Flappy Bird dies. You know, sort of situation.
A slow death.
That's right. You know, try to do something interesting with it. If you got that much of a high profile and sort of, you know, make an internet legend out of yourself. But I do think it's pretty interesting. Did you ever play the game or did you check it out while it was up?
No, I did not. I don't have access to a smartphone, so I didn't really get a chance. But I did watch footage of it, and it does look very basic. I think the one thing that was just driving me nuts was every time someone mentioned, oh, this is the Dark Souls of mobile games. And really going, what? That's a thing now?
No, it's not. It's not, and neither is it the Citizen Kane of video games while we're at it.
Is it a Blade Runner video game? Sort of Star Wars?
Could be. Maybe. Yeah, he's actually, a Flappy Bird is actually a replicant the whole time. Yeah. Spoilers,
well,
sorry.
Yeah, you ruined it for everyone. Well, it's gone now, so they won't be able to find out.
That's true.
But the other side of this, and what's pretty disturbing, is the people who basically started sending the guy death threats and attacking him. And I was looking, there's a Giant Bomb article this week when they were posting some of the tweets people were saying to him, and it is just insane.
Yeah, people, I mean, come on, gamers. Mm-hmm. Come on. What? I just don't understand why some people do that sort of stuff. And you see it all the time. I mean, there's been the whole thing and backlash against women developers, but you know, in the last year, but not even getting into all that, like, God, what was his name? Phil Fish, but I'm actually thinking of the guy that worked on Call of Duty, David Vondahar.
Okay.
Who actually know and used to work with, but he posted this article about how he made like one tiny little change to like the fire rate or the damage output on one gun.
1.1% decrease.
Yeah, in a patch, and it was like in a patch note somewhere, and he got death threats, like real death threats from people. I don't understand how people can react so severely to that sort of thing. And you like to think that they're not serious and that it's not true, but man, it's tough.
Yeah, when you hear like 10,000 people saying, "We want you dead, drop dead, I'm going to come kill you," I mean, that's got to eventually take a toll on anybody.
Yeah, so maybe I would like to retract my plan for making Flappy Bird a $10 app and holding it hostage for $1 million. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I didn't think this idea through well enough.
Yeah, and for those listening, that was Jamie's idea, not mine. I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Just keep me out.
Nah, but however, we just release the source code. Just do that.
Mm-hmm. And we'll probably talk a little bit more about that, you know, the psychology of gamers later on in the cast. I guess the last thing I just want to talk about now is that, I guess for me personally, I've never been able to, like, succumb to that hive mind or fanboy mentality that a lot of people get. I've never been, you know, so emotionally attached to a game that if something changes, I would be like, you know, I'm going to tell the developer to go F himself and kill his family and all that. Just never reach that state of hostility towards someone.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem worth it. I don't feel that invested in even the games that I love the most.
Yeah, me too. All right, so let's move on and talk a little bit about some of the games we've been playing.
Okay.
For me, the game that I've been taking a look at is a recently released game, or I think recently considered finished game on Steam called Loadout.
Yes, me too.
Yep, and it's a pretty interesting game. It sort of goes for the Team Fortress vibe of, you know, this very cartoony world, very exaggerated models. But it does it with pretty much a hard M rating filter. Like, arms get ripped off, guys will run around with, like, their spine hanging out. Lots of use of flipping people the bird and so on.
Yeah, posthumously, after death in some points, my favorite little touch.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that it's basically started from the get-go as a free-to-play game. So you can go on Steam, download it, and play without spending a cent. And what they're doing with it is, instead of being, I guess I wouldn't necessarily call Team Fortress a realistic game, but Loadout is more, I guess, fanciful or more arcade-like than Team Fortress. This is, goes back to the days of Quake and Unreal, where characters are, you know, running around, jumping, and performing all kinds of crazy acrobatics in an attempt to avoid that rail gun or that rocket launcher.
Mm-hmm.
And the game has an interesting hook in the sense that all the guns in the game are those that you actually create or you assemble through parts that you can buy using the in-game currency. I think it's called plutonium.
Plutonium, yeah.
And so there's four different types of guns in the game: pulse, rocket launcher, laser, and rifle. So those basically represent essentially the framework of your gun. And then from there, you can modify different parts of the gun, and that basically changes its utility. So you could take a rifle and replace its barrel with a short-range barrel and turn it into, like, a shotgun. Or you could take your laser gun and add healing bullets to it, and then, lo and behold, you have the medic gun, basically, from Team Fortress.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot there in terms of how far you can take these four different weapon types and essentially just create your own insane loadouts with it. And the beauty of Loadout is that the game is entirely free to play. There really isn't any pay to win or monetization ickiness in the game. It does have premium currency in the form of space bucks. And from what I could see in the game, they're used for essentially two things. One, you can buy experience boosters, like your character has. You have a profile level to your account, and when you level up enough, or your guns level up enough, the parts make it like a very marginal improvement. So maybe instead of doing 15 points of damage, a level 2 gun does maybe 15.3 damage, you know, little stuff like that. But the rest of it is strictly for cosmetic, and there's a whole lot of insane outfits and things you can put on your guys. You can buy new taunts. There's a taunt where the guy's like dancing while give everyone the finger, which is hilarious to watch.
Yep.
And for being a straight off the bat free to play game, there's a lot of, I think, very smart design and great marketing that the game is doing in terms of not trying to revel in, you know, monetization, you know, give us $10, we'll give you plus 20 bullets and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jamie, you've been playing, I think you said you just started playing it today, right?
Last night and today, yeah.
So what do you think of it?
I like it. I think it's a lot of fun, especially for a free-to-play game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. The vibe that I get from it is Quake World. You know, it's mm-hmm. so fast-paced. You move so quickly, you die so quickly, you kill so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You complete the map's objectives pretty rapidly. Most of the matches are fairly short, and it's really frantic, and they sort of baked that in to everything about the game. I love, like, the animations. Like, your mm-hmm. dude will be firing, and if you turn mm-hmm. and try to run away, he'll, like, actually turn backward and hold mm-hmm. the gun behind his head and fire mm-hmm. behind him as he runs mm-hmm. and fire, you know, to the side and do all this crazy stuff. And that, you know, I think the gore is a little over the top. I could have done without, you know, seeing people's innards and mm-hmm. getting blown in half and stuff, but, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love the taunts and the animations, you know, when you die and the guy is just lying on his back and then he sticks his arm up and flips, you know, the bird to whoever killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool. And I do respect them for not having any of the in-game purchase stuff tied to the weapons,
mm-hmm.
At least not directly. So you can't buy the plutonium to upgrade your weapons. You can't buy extra damage to your mm-hmm. weapons. You can't buy new types of loadouts without mm-hmm. earning them. That's all through the game's in-game currency.
Mm-hmm.
The closest you can get, I guess, is doing the coin doublers or the XP doublers, mm-hmm. you know, to get that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, all of the space bucks, which, by the way, is a totally awesome name for an in-game currency, mm-hmm. for a real money mm-hmm. currency. Yeah, you just buy cosmetic stuff with that. And they kind of limited that. And if you click through, like, their little tips, you know, they make it a point of saying, like, nope, this is not a pay to win game.
Mm-hmm.
The only stuff that you can actually pay for is cosmetic stuff. Mm-hmm. I do sometimes feel, and maybe this isn't accurate, but that people who have played longer and thus unlocked more options are difficult for me to deal with,
mm-hmm.
and they can just dominate. But it's sort of difficult to parse that. Like, is that because they've done that, or is it just because they are more practiced at the game
yeah.
and know the map better and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
That's kind of the main problem I've got with the whole post Call of Duty unlock.
Yeah, it's,
you know, system to first person shooters. That's always kind of annoyed me. I want to be able to do everything I can do off the bat.
Yeah, that's a good point about that. It's one of the things I really didn't like about Call of Duty. Even though I love their prestige system, I love how they design this to hook you to keep playing. But on the flip side, I hate playing a game where the guy is inherently better than me, not because he played longer, or I mean he's better skilled than me, but just because he spent an extra hour or an extra 2 hours and his gun does 20 more damage than mine, so it doesn't matter. Even if I shoot him first, he's just going, you know, turn around, one hit, boom, I'm dead.
Yep.
Right deal.
Yeah, so that's sort of annoying. It's like whenever you see somebody on there who has, like, crazy effects on their guns, mm-hmm. or it has a lot of, like, cosmetic stuff, like a different character model mm-hmm. and crazy clothes, you're like, I always just try to avoid that person. just stay away. Just let him take the flag or let mm-hmm. him capture the capture point. They can do that. I'll hide over here.
Yep, and I definitely want to talk a bit more about the balance of the game in a minute. Two last things about the cosmetic options or the monetization. There is, I think, only one bit of gameplay element that you can spend space bucks on, and that's, as you said, just unlocking more loadouts. So what they are is essentially any guns that you make get stored in your locker or your inventory, and you can only have, I think, 6 guns total saved, and those slots are unlocked by leveling up. But then if you want to get any more slots, you then would have to spend the space bucks. But that essentially is just for saving your gun design. So it's not like, although actually I'm not 100% sure on that, if once you unlock like rifle part 1, if that stays unlocked forever to your account or just to that one gun. I'll probably take a look at that later.
I think it's tied to the chassis. So if you unlock like, you know, the flame ammo for the rifle, then you can put that in any rifle. But you have to unlock, you have to purchase it with plutonium again for the
launcher,
scatter chassis, or the rocket chassis, or whatever.
Okay. And the other thing that I find interesting about the game is that they have one sole female model in the game, and she's as, you know, cartoony and over the top as men. So I thought that was kind of interesting, because as you said, this last year has been a bit of interesting debate about women in the industry and somewhat of the misogyny and sexism. So I just found it kind of funny that they have a woman in there who's just as crazy as a man. Like, she fits into the world as opposed to just being designed strictly for TNA.
Yeah, yeah, she's doesn't really fit the sexy model of any video game that I've seen. You know, she's big, she's, you know, rude looking, she's kind of gross in terms of like the taunts that she does and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, that was interesting to see.
Yep. Now, talking about the gameplay loadout, as you said a few minutes ago, it's hard to tell right now if the game is really balanced around skill or it is more about the time. One thing I noticed, at least for me, is that I found things a little bit too chaotic in some sense, that essentially two of the weapons in the game, the rifle and the pulse, you pretty much have to aim manually to be able to hit someone with. But rocket launcher and the lasers are a lot more forgiving in terms of aiming. And there's definitely a debate, or at least from what I've been seeing on the forums, of whether or not those guns are a little bit too good for not really needing to aim. Like, I'm having trouble hitting someone with my rifle, they just turn around, aim their laser at me, and they're doing direct damage instantly. And I'm just, you know, flailing around, watching my bullets go everywhere except for hitting the guy where I want him to be.
Yeah, the rocket launcher seemed a little underpowered to me, actually, just in terms of, like, the area of effect, the blast damage that it was doing. But the beam weapons did seem a little overpowered to me. And you could just sort of point in the general direction and then just wave everywhere and you'll hit more often than not.
Yeah.
Especially if there's a group of enemies. Yeah. You know, you could damage several at a time. So, yeah.
And considering how low everyone's health value is, even though those weapons don't do as much damage, the fact that you're getting consistent damage on someone is a lot better than getting one hit rarely that does a lot of damage, because by the time you actually get that shot, you're pretty much dead. Or at least I'm pretty much dead.
Yeah, you're really fragile in that game.
I think that's sort of keeping with this very frenetic, very chaotic world that Loadout is in.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say the only other problem or complaint I have with Loadout at the moment is strictly from a content point of view. In terms of cosmetic, there's a bunch of stuff you can put on your guy, but in terms of weapons, there really isn't a lot right now to get excited about. As we said, there's 4 chassis, and then there's a very basic tech tree that you can unlock the parts for, but it's nowhere near, you know, the level of Team Fortress Insanity with 20 different rocket launchers, 10 different types of knives, but truth be told, that is expected, as the game was, I think, officially released last week. So if they can start adding more of that content in and getting it up to like a Team Fortress level, I think Loadout would be a really great complement to the game.
Yeah, I think they bury a lot of the stuff, or they gate it behind levels. So, you know, you have your grenade slot, and there's like a whole list of other items that you can put in that slot, like, you know, mines and
shields,
shields and like decoy health packs that damage people when they try to pick them up, and disguises and all this other crazy stuff. But it's gated behind these progressively higher level requirements.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. And, you know, I'm like what, level 5, 6, something like that, mm-hmm. and can't get to most of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know if the pace of introducing new gameplay-changing items like that is quick enough.
Yeah. And the other issue that I just thought of is that I have been having some connection issues with the game. It's been saying, you know, my internet's not working, or I've been kicked out of matches for a dropped connection. But they have been working on that, and that's probably not going to be a long-term problem.
Yeah. Yeah, the only other complaint that I have is that I wish you could browse games by or specify what type of game or game mode you wanted to join, because you know, I really like a couple of them and am kind of lukewarm on one. And the best you can do is go into a lobby, and then it has like a voting system where people can vote on what game mode and what map to play. Mm-hmm. And the best you can do is that if you don't like the way that the votes are going, is to drop out of the lobby and then join a different one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which doesn't seem very efficient.
Yeah, the game modes, I'm sort of, you know, lukewarm about them as well. I like a few of them, and then there's some that just seem a little bit boring, but their multiplayer lobby system seems a little bit basic. Like, you have to wait 80 seconds for the match to start unless everyone votes for it, and it just can be a little bit slow, especially considering how fast the rest of the game is.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. There's a big waiting period between matches. Yeah. I'd rather just let's just keep going, you know, let's reset the scoreboard and keep playing with the same group, and new people can come and join the server as spaces open up. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why they went that route.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think maybe they wanted to provide a lot of opportunities for people to change their weapon crafting, or like, you know, to spend that plutonium or whatever to make new weapons. But I think it just kind of ended up getting in the way.
Okay, so let's move on. And Jamie, do you have any games that you've been playing that you would like to talk about?
No, I mean, that's mostly been it. I finished Assassin's Creed 4 a few weeks ago, I guess it's been at this point. And I went kind of crazy with that. I collected almost everything in that game, and there's a lot to collect in that game. I got like all the treasure chests, all the Animus pieces, all of the treasure maps. I hacked all the computers. I did a lot of stuff. It was just so fun to be in that world that I didn't mind just kind of cruising around and climbing and swinging and doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I put as much into that Assassin's Creed game as I did AC, was it Brotherhood? Which is the one that I liked the most previously. Mm-hmm. And coming off of 3, which I didn't like very much, I was really surprised at how good I found this one.
It's kind of weird how the Assassin's Creed series has changed. I remember the first one was just, it was an interesting idea, but it didn't really seem to go anywhere. And then when they changed the design for Assassin's Creed 2, it was like, oh my god, it's amazing kind of deal.
Yeah. Yeah, they kept pounding on it until they got it, and then I think in 3, they went too far with, like, cramming new things in without taking old things out, without any consideration to whether it made any sense at all. Mm-hmm. And you just had, like, this weird mishmash of this stew of different systems and gameplay elements where, mm-hmm. you know, like, why am I doing, like, trading? Why is this whole system even in here? Mm-hmm. And in 4, they really pulled back and said, okay, this is like a different setting, a different kind of game. Mm-hmm. And they stripped out a lot of those elements and maybe kept a few too many collectibles, says the person who got most of them. But but still, really good. I would recommend it.
Yeah.
So besides that and Team Fortress and Loadout, that's pretty much what I've been playing.
Cool. Yeah, I think the last time I actually sat down and just tried 100% a game was Batman Arkham City. Yes.
City. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the last time I really felt compelled to go for 100%. I did play Saints Row 4 about 2 weeks ago when it was during its free weekend, and I liked it, but it just got to the point where it started to feel really repetitive. I didn't really feel that compulsion to go for 100% in that.
Mm. Yeah, I played a lot of that game. I didn't quite 100% it. Mm-hmm. There were some of the mission types. I was just like, this is too difficult. It's not fun. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to bother with it. And I'm pretty sure I did 100% Arkham City and Arkham.
Yeah.
The one before it.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. Okay.
A lot of Riddler trophies.
Yeah, so many freaking little green trophies to collect.
Yeah.
And I love how in the latest one, the one that didn't do so well, Origins, they said that the grand reward for 100%ing that is you get a Riddler trophy after all that. That's like the most booby prize I could think of.
Yeah, that's great. I'll watch that on YouTube.
All right. So let's move on then to the to our main discussion then for the cast. And that is about your book, Jamie. So if you could talk a little bit more about your website and kind of what the book is going to be about.
Sure. So I run this little website called psychologyofgames.com. Mm-hmm. And it started out a few years ago when I was just kind of looking around for like a blogging project. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed writing about games, but I didn't want to do just another general gaming site or, you know, like a diary or and review games.
Yeah.
There were a million of those. Mm-hmm. And in about that time, I've been reading a lot of psychology books, especially around like behavioral economics and the psychology of decision making and those sort of things. And I kept thinking like, you know, wow, I'd read about this and I'd say that could actually explain why this game was designed the way it is. Right. That explains why people how people spend money on games and in games. And somebody should really write about that. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I'm somebody. I could write about that. Mm-hmm. And I have a background in psychology. I have a PhD in psychology. Mm-hmm. And I actually work as a psychologist, an industrial organizational psychologist, which is a different kind of psychology. It's psychology of workplace. Mm-hmm. And I do things like selection and how do you match people's skills with the requirements of a job and how do you design jobs and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I did have this background and started the website and just on a lark to see how it would go. And it kind of started growing an audience and over time led to other opportunities like doing some freelance writing for Edge Magazine and GamePro back when GamePro existed. I got invited to join the blogging network at psychologytoday.com and did some consulting work with a couple of different companies and some small projects there and writing for currently doing some freelance writing for Game Show, which is a YouTube series, YouTube video show series. Mm-hmm. That's done by PBS and, been contributing some to the scripts for that lately. And then, at one point I kind of just decided like, well, what's my end game? You know, what am I going to do with this? The freelancing stuff is fine. I could keep doing that forever and I could keep writing the website forever because I really like doing it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I thought I should write a book. Mm-hmm. So put together a proposal, you know, did some research on how to do that, wrote this big gnarly giant nonfiction book proposal. And then started searching for a literary agent and took a few months to convince somebody to take a chance on this stupid idea and think that it might actually be worth writing and that people would buy it and eventually found one. And she agreed to represent me and she shopped the proposal around to all the different publishers. I was talking to her earlier today, this close, and you can't see me, but I'm holding up my fingers very, very close together, this close on finalizing a contract with a publisher. So somebody saw the proposal and said, yes, I would like to publish this for you and do all the things that a publisher does. Mm-hmm. So the way that it traditionally works in nonfiction book publishing is that you don't write the book first. You sell it and then you say like, okay, I need 8 months or 12 months or whatever to actually write the book. So once that is finalized and agreed upon and signed, then I will continue work in earnest. I've actually been working. I've got about a third of the book drafted already just because I couldn't help myself. But once that's finalized, then, you know, we'll set a date and it'll come out.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I would not have guessed when I started this whole thing that this would be where it would end up.
Yeah. For my site, I pretty much looked at it the same way as you. I didn't want to do like a regular news site or, you know, just write a very clickbait worthy articles. I figured there's hundreds of those out there. I wanted to do something to stand out. And that's sort of how GameWisdom was born. I started writing in 2007 on my own little basic blog, which was all right, but it was pretty much small, even smaller than this at the moment. And I just figured, I have a friend, Ken, he's the one who designed the site, and I just wanted to do something interesting and just a way of displaying my talents and understanding design and the industry in general. And I was in college. I actually had an interest in psychology as well. I took, I think, 3 or 4 different psychology courses. I almost got my minor, but then the last moment I decided to do a course on web design, and then I just couldn't fit that last one in. And that's one of the things I do kick myself about.
Like, no, I think you made the right choice.
So with the book, do you have like a working title or anything like that yet?
The working title, which is entirely subject to change, is Mind Games. And then there's a lengthy subtitle, something like Why People Are Jerks in Call of Duty, Why You Can't Quit Candy Crush, Why You Won't Unsubscribe from World of Warcraft, and 13 other questions that psychology can answer about video games.
Cool.
It's probably going to be too long a subtitle. I may have to trim that down.
Yeah.
But the idea is that each chapter sort of presents a question and then looks at what research on psychology says about that. So one of the chapters is about, like, what does anonymity and de-individuation do to people online? Mm-hmm. And, you know, why does it make them jerks? And another chapter would be like, you know, what does our choice of avatar say about us? Another chapter is like, why do we fall for Steam sales and other, you know, cheap sales? Another one is like, why do people spend so much money on microtransactions, like we were talking about before?
Yeah.
So, you know, each chapter will have a question and a topic like that. And a lot of these are drawn from articles that I've already written for the website. So several cases, I'll just be taking those articles and greatly expanding on them. I'll have a lot larger word count to play with in the book, obviously. A worrisome degree, in fact. It's kind of intimidating to think that I got to fill an entire chapter, let alone an entire book with this sort of stuff. But yeah, I'll get there.
It can be somewhat crazy. I know as someone who writes for a site as well that sometimes I start a piece, I'm like, it's only going to be, you know, 600-700 words, and then it turns out to be like 1,500, 2,000 words. Or on the flip side, I'll start writing something and go, yeah, this is going to be a big piece. I got so much to say about it. And then it's only like a 400-word article, and I got nothing else to really talk about with it.
You know, if you can say it in 400 words, though, then say it in 400 words or 300 if you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writing is easy. Writing a lot is easy.
Yeah.
Writing a little is hard.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So, yeah, it's a different format.
So the book itself is not just going to cover one aspect of the industry. It's just going to cover all these different questions, which are, in a sense, different topics, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's like three sections. One is, like, why do gamers do what they do? The other is, why do game developers develop games the way that they do? And the other is, why do people who market and sell games do what they do?
Interesting.
So those sort of three broad topics and broken down into 5 or 6 chapters each.
Cool.
Yeah.
So are there any parts about the book or any topics that you find particularly interesting that you're really excited to write about?
Pretty much everything that's in there I'm interested in exploring. I think there's one thing that gets overlooked a lot in video games, especially by people who aren't familiar with the industry and with the hobby, is just how social they are.
Yeah,
and how social psychology theories apply so often, because more and more, you know, you look at any new game, it's going to have social elements, even if that social element is just like a leaderboard or a way to share progress through friends list or Facebook. That's like the bare baseline. And then you get into like massively multiplayer games, which are practically societies in any meaningful sense of the word, into themselves. And they have their own sets of, you know, mores and social standards that people follow, and the same psychological principles that govern how we behave in groups in the real world often apply to video games as well. So it's been really interesting to pore through that. And there's more and more research that's being done every month as well. People studying behavior in video games and doing academic scientific research about it that's being published in peer-reviewed journals. You know, I got a Google alert set up and to, you know, bring up that stuff, and I find something new every couple of days.
I think it's interesting you mentioned the social aspect, because I think that has been one of like the biggest stigmas against the video games, or at least the biggest stigma in terms of pop culture, is, you know, anyone who plays video games is this guy living in his basement, not interacting with the outside world. But, I mean, I know more people, and I'm friendly with more people that I met through online, through playing video games, than I actually have around here, because I really couldn't find people who are interested in game design or the industry that I am, at least in my neighborhood. So it's been great to reach out and talk to people like you and all the designers and writers I've had on the cast.
Yeah, the internet's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of joked with my wife, who doesn't play games, has never been really interested in them, mm-hmm. that, you know, if I couldn't turn her into a gamer, that I was going to create my own from scratch. And so my two daughters are I'm making them into gamers. I'm getting them into it. They play a ton of Minecraft and Little Big Planet and games like that. So, yep.
Awesome.
It's not a stereotype that holds at all.
Now, I guess here's another interesting stigma, one that people have been, of course, debating about for what seems like ever with the game industry, and that has to do with violence and the video game industry. Mm-hmm. We've seen, you know, papers and Fox News pieces almost like on a monthly basis. Someone saying, video games are violent, they cause us to be violent. And another piece saying, no, that's not true, and back and forth and so on and so forth. I guess from your point of view, as someone who studies psychology and such, what do you think about that always heated debate?
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask that question. it's a complex topic. And if you do a survey of the psychology literature and the experiments that people have done in psychology and communications, those fields, you get conflicting information.
Yeah.
You know, some people say like, no, doesn't cause violence at all. Some people says, well, it does, but only for children, or maybe only if people are predisposed to that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. And other people say, oh my God, it's turning us into a society of psychopaths. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from my reading of it, and I'm not as big an expert as you could probably mm-hmm. find with very little effort, mm-hmm. you know, out there if you were interested in a real serious mm-hmm. examination of the question. But, you know, in my experience and what I've read is that it doesn't really, mm-hmm. I think, more antisocial and violent people are attracted to certain kinds of games mm-hmm. because they let them engage in those kinds of mm-hmm. activities. So I think there's a kind of a selection bias there or like a self-selecting mm-hmm. effect going yeah. on there. The effects on other people tend to be extremely small, extremely weak, and extremely short-lived.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a typical experiment might have somebody play like a violent game, like play Grand Theft Auto or mm-hmm. or Doom or whatever, and then they might have them go into a debriefing area where somebody posing as like an administrative person accidentally knocks over some pencils off a desk, and mm-hmm. and the measure of antisocialness is whether or not they help pick up the pencils.
Okay.
So you got a lot of weird operationalization questions there. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to get at this sort of stuff through survey work. And it's difficult to conduct a study that accurately recreates the effect of playing lots and lots and lots of, you know, hundreds of hours of these types of games.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to do. These sort of questions have been asked since, violent television and violent comic books and violent movies and violent, I suppose, radio and Greek
rock
tragedies.
And roll and all that.
Yeah, music and rap and rock and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are bigger issues mm-hmm. with gaming than violence. I think, mm-hmm. you know, you get around to things like portrayal of minorities and women mm-hmm. and can be problematic in various parts of the gaming industry and the products. Mm-hmm. I think addictive, you know, quality of some of the games can get out of hand mm-hmm. For some people. I think just the way that some games are designed, as we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier, to suck money out of your wallet 99 cents at a time mm-hmm. Is more troublesome than, you know, the effects of violence on behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm pretty much in agreement with you on that. I don't think video games really are turning people into violent killers and whatever. But I do think there is the people who are predisposed towards those behaviors generally tend to gravitate towards it. And then people will say, you know, because 10 people like Call of Duty who went out and did something violent, that video games are turning people violent. And I don't think that's really the case.
Yeah, you got to be really skeptical of the source of the information too. Mm-hmm. If it's coming from a politician mm-hmm. or anything like that, or somebody who has a vested interest in the answer to the question, mm-hmm. You got to be really skeptical and got to look at the science and what the good research says.
Mm-hmm. I have two quick funny stories about that. One, when I was in college, I took, I think it was either a gender studies or some kind of women's studies course. And I think I was like the only guy, or one of only two guys in that class. And the teacher, who was a woman, one day she basically gave a lecture on how violent video games are going to ruin us and all that. And I just sat there going, And then the next day, we had to like give like a presentation or something. So I basically came up and just completely rebuffed everything that she said about violent video games, that, you know, that's wrong. And then she gave me like a D on that afterwards. No.
That's the best D you ever earned, though.
And then, second thing, this is funny, last year, out of just a complete lore, I turn on TV and I turn on Katie Couric, who's doing an entire thing about video games and violence and all that. So I wrote an actual piece for the site decrying against that, and then when I posted on the Katie Couric board, I think, like, no one looked at it at all. I'm like, aw. I could have gotten all those soccer moms and, and all that audience looking at my site.
Yeah, I mean, people, it's an easy-to-sell narrative. Yeah. That these things are bad for your children, and so it gets sold and it gets bought.
Now, going on to monetization, as you just said, how some games are designed clearly as money grabs as opposed to actual gameplay. You look at free-to-play games like that, what are the telltale signs that you see, or from like a psychological standpoint, that basically scream out monetization or pay-to-win or stuff like that?
That it's taking it too far, or just that it exists?
I would say taking it too far, because I think most people are generally aware that it exists, but then there's, of course, a case where games are being designed strictly for the whales, or the guys who are going to get hooked and spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on the game and don't really care about anything else.
Yeah, I think the time or the energy mechanic is a big one for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like we were saying, like you only get so many moves or so many lives, and you've got to buy additional ones. Mm-hmm. I think also getting you to spam your friends or send requests out or send mm-hmm. invitations to play is sort of another one that mm-hmm. companies will do that as an alternative to paying in order just to get more people to play. And so hopefully that, you know, one of them will end up being those whales. Mm-hmm. I think that...
Jamie, I don't want to interrupt you, but you're coming in a little bit distorted now.
Oh, is that any better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. That's weird. I don't know what that was. So, I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with just monitoring yourself and being aware of how much you're spending, and that is the point where it starts to become a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, free to play, I won't paint with too broad a brush. Mm-hmm. We just spent quite some time talking about a free to play game that we both like, mm-hmm. you know, in the form of Loadout. And so I think that it's not an automatic thing that like this is evil or this is mm-hmm. bad or this is taking advantage of you. We just kind of got to pay attention to what you're spending and set a budget and do the math on what the conversion is between purple diamonds and dollars or mm-hmm. pounds or whatever it is where you live, and, you know, keep track of how much you spend. And if mm-hmm. it's worth it to you, then that's fine. You know, mm-hmm. if it's, you'd rather do that than spend $50-$60 all at once on a game, mm-hmm. Then that works out. But just, you know, paying attention to how much you're playing and whether or not you're spending money on something that you wouldn't spend money on normally if you hadn't already been invested in this or been mm-hmm. so close to finishing the level that it's worth $3.99 to get that lollipop sledgehammer or whatever it is in Candy Crush to beat the level. And, you know, getting too wrapped up in leaderboards and competition with your friends. A lot of the games build social elements into them where, you know, it'll say like, oh, you were only 70 points shy of beating, you know, so-and-so's, you know, beating Josh's record mm-hmm. on this level. And mm-hmm. spend 99 cents for another life so you can keep going. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of that sort of stuff. So, you know, it personal responsibility is sort of what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you just said is a good point about not painting free-to-play with a broad brush. I see a lot of articles and a lot of people posting about how, you know, free-to-play is the devil, it's evil, all free-to-play games are wrong, microtransactions have to be abolished, and et cetera, And I think you're definitely right that not all free-to-play games are the same. There are a lot of good ones out there. Loadout, League of Legends. I've mm-hmm. spoken with Chris Garner, who's working on Below. It's a browser-based free-to-play game. And I think one of the problems, though, is that a few bad apples have pretty much spoiled the bunch in a matter of speaking. And it's becoming harder to sell a really good free-to-play game because your game is being put next to Candy Crush or Dungeon Keeper or Farmville and so on. I just wonder, if that will sort of be the nail in the coffin for free-to-play games, or will there be a way to get around that?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be some people who want to create the little Skinner box that gets people to pay more money, and then there's always going to be people who have more of a vision around, you know, a game, a product, an experience that they want to craft, and free-to-play is just one way to sell it, and, you know, one tool. Of course, having free-to-play makes direct impact on your game mechanics, so there's only so much you can do or can't get away with. I also kind of think that free-to-play gets a lot of flack from people who never play free-to-play or aren't in that target audience. You get a lot of hardcore gamers, for lack of a better term, you know, people who are, I'm going to go buy the Xbox and the PlayStation 4, and I'm going to spend $60 on this game, and I'm going to play it. And no, don't talk to me about Candy Crush or, you know, even something like, what's the Blizzard one? The collectible card game. Hearthstone. You know, I think they see, and this has to do with sort of the expansion of the definition of game and gamer and game player. As that definition gets bigger to include things like casual games and cell phone games and games that your mom or your girlfriend or your cousin, you know, who don't play Call of Duty would ever play or would be interested in playing. A lot of hardcore gamers look at that and sort of see that as an invasion of their identity because they have so much of their self-concept tied up in this idea of, you know, this is my hobby. It's been like this forever. I was doing it when it was not cool, you know, and your reputation took a real hit to be into Mario and Zelda and whatever it was that you were into, Quake, Half-Life. And they see that expansion of the gaming market as an attack on their identity because it's altering what it means to be a gamer, what it means to be into games. And some people don't react well to that.
Yeah, especially with microtransactions. I remember, like, I see this on a lot of forums. Like, I remember looking at, like, the Atlas forum and even on Steam. Like, the second game announces that DLC, there's always going to be 10 or 15 posts saying, DLC, no sales, pay to win. I don't want to deal with that. And you're right, that definition of a gamer, I think, is a strong element of that. When did you first start playing video games?
I was playing them as long as I could remember. Atari 2600 and Apple II. And then before that, in the arcade. I was an arcade rat.
Yeah.
I lived at the games people play in Bally's castle, or Aladdin's castle, 25 cents at a time. The original microtransaction.
Yeah, but I grew up same way, arcade. My first system was Nintendo. I think I had an Atari 2600 at some point. But you're right that the popular culture, the opinion of gamer, has just gone through so much. I mean, I remember pretty much from mid-80s to most of the 90s, anytime someone was seen as being a gamer on TV, it was, you know, a negative connotation. You are a nerd. Ew, you're not popular. And then in the thousands, you know, that whole turnaround, you know, there's, I think, some called geek chic now. The nerd is now very popular, or we're accepted. And it's sort of, I think, given a lot of people that entitlement or that sense of power, that when you start seeing casual games or monetization games that sort of break the mold or try to change, you know, the established blueprint, that people are feeling unusually threatened and hostile towards. And it's the same thing with, you know, the whole sexism and misogyny in the industry. I mean, we see people decrying, saying, you know, that's fine. That's been a part of the industry. You know, it's a cornerstone and crap like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't even know if it has so much to do with the microtransactions, although I think that is its own issue. As much as it is just this is applying to people who I don't identify with, and now they are being part of this thing that used to be my thing and part of my identity, and I'm not like that person. Maybe I don't like that person. Maybe I don't care one way or another, but they're not me.
And they're invading my territory. They're going to change everything that I know and love. And that's one of, like, the most common defenses or for misogyny in the industry. People saying, you know, the feminists are going to come in. They're going to change games. And we won't be able to have, you know, beautiful people in our games anymore. And it's going to ruin everything.
Take away my space marine. Yeah,
with his five chins and muscle the size of a head.
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, it's changing, and like I said, my kids play Minecraft and a few other games, and one of my daughters in particular plays a lot of free to play games like Dragon City and some other ones on the iPad. And they are going to be the ones sort of setting the tone going forward. And it's going to be a much bigger clubhouse for people to play in. Maybe there will be sort of separate rooms within that clubhouse that we can find to kind of stake out our own territory while acknowledging that, you know, this, hey, like film, like TV, this is not like a special thing. This is something that everybody is into.
Yep. And that just because you're not a fan of something doesn't mean that it has to be destroyed or removed. There are people who enjoy it, and it's also in reverse. There's people out there who hate first-person shooters, who hate platformers, so it's all right that they don't have to like that stuff as long, and they're not, you know, trying to tear it down and destroy it.
Yeah, yep. And that's why Half-Life 3 will be a platformer.
With trading
cards. Collectible card game, yep.
Using the Oculus Rift.
Right. I'll play it.
Well, we all are going to play. It'll be part of like the summer, probably 2080 sale at some point.
That's right. I'll play it for my iron lung and my life support system.
Mm-hmm. Or Steam will just download into all of our brains. You know, you don't even need to buy it. It'll just say, oh, we're turning on, we're pulling the switch. Now everyone has Half-Life 3.
That's right. Half-Life 3 could be the afterlife.
I think that's the new tagline. Half-Life's the afterlife.
It's the singularity and the afterlife all merged into one.
Can you think of any other topics or anything you want to talk about with the book?
Nope, other than just stay tuned and go to psychologyofgames.com to, you know, see, to get a good sample of the types of articles that will be featured in it.
I think with that, we can start wrapping it up. All right. So, Jamie, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on. I can't wait to see the book. It sounds very interesting.
Well, thanks. This was a lot of fun. I'm glad to have done it and appreciate the chance to come on.
Yep. And I would definitely love to have you back on again in the future.
Yeah. Anytime.
And I will, of course, have the psychology website on the podcast notes. And definitely, I'll be looking forward to the book, and I hope a lot of our listeners will be, too.
Very cool. Thanks.
Yep, no problem. All right, so with that, we're going to wrap things up for this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you would like to contribute to this site, either by writing a guest piece or by appearing on the podcast, feel free to send me an email. You can find the information and guidelines under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And with that said, have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.